Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's gonna hate you, and she's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha. Welcome to the Progressive Radio Network. This is Nature Bats Last. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This December 23rd, 2014 edition of Nature Bats Last, like future episodes, is pre-recorded. As a result, there's no chance to take your questions on the air. Our theme song is provided as a gift with our thanks by Aprazin, and you can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Background music for a couple of our regular segments, including the next one, is provided by 17-year-old Scottish teenager Rhianne Farrigan. This week's episode brings news and analysis about the American torture program and dropping oil prices. We continue our news segment called Real or Fake News, and we have another Doomer of the Week. We wrap up with a brief climate change update as well. Tonight's first segment is news beyond the echo chamber of the mainstream, and we'll mention two stories. Guy, what do you have for us?
From Washington's blog on December 17th comes a story headlined, American Public Supports Torture Because They Don't Know This. The story includes these tidbits, each of which includes links to the evidence. New polls show that even after the Senate torture report showed that torture is unnecessary and doesn't work, Americans still think torture is necessary and works. Why? Because they still don't know the truth. Because the mainstream media has hidden it from them. Specifically, Americans still believe that torture works to produce helpful intelligence that helps keep us safe. Americans wouldn't support torture if they knew the following facts, proven beyond any doubt. All of the top interrogation experts say that torture does not produce actionable intelligence, even in a ticking time bomb scenario. Torture doesn't reduce terrorism. In fact, the opposite is true. It simply creates new terrorists and terrorist groups. Most of those tortured were completely innocent of any crime. Children were tortured, too. The specific type of torture used by the U.S. is famous for producing false evidence. People have known for thousands of years that torture, stripped of the torturer's lies, is really just a way to create fear, i.e. a form of terrorism. Indeed, America's recently leaked criteria for putting people on the terror watch list says torture is terror. While the mainstream media gives overwhelming coverage to pro-torture guests, those people have a very strong incentive to lie. Specifically, virtually all of them are war criminals under international and U.S. law who are afraid of being prosecuted for their creation and approval of the torture program. Indeed, many are calling for their prosecution, and a former top Air Force interrogator notes that government officials knew they were vulnerable for war crime prosecution. They have, from the beginning, been trying to prevent an investigation into war crimes. The Nazis used the same enhanced interrogation techniques the U.S. did and even called it the same thing. The Founding Fathers were strongly opposed to torture and enshrined a torture ban in the Constitution. This is not the first time America tortured. Americans tortured Filipinos over 100 years ago as a way to terrorize the population into submission. CIA torture in Vietnam was so severe that most prisoners died during torture, and the torture was so horrific that those who didn't die during torture usually killed themselves soon after. Americans also taught the leaders of other countries how to torture. The detainees held up a poster boy justification for torture, which actually proves the opposite. Plenty of information there with plenty of links. Mike, what do you have beyond the mainstream today?
Well, the hits keep coming, don't they? My piece this week is from Transition Voice, and it's titled, headline is, Cheap Oil Just Keeps Coming. It's by R. Michael Conley. It's more of a conventional piece addressed to those of us participating in the car culture and who are concerned about oil prices and how they will impact the U.S. and us as individuals. The stunning plunge in oil prices, almost 45% since June, has rolled the global oil markets, creating new winners and losers almost overnight. It has also unlocked a number of potential problems and opportunities we would be wise to consider. In our consumer-based economy, savings at the gas pump provide a direct stimulus to the economy, freeing up a reservoir of new discretionary dollars to fuel the economy. Indeed, SUV and small truck sales are skyrocketing, and fuel-intensive sectors like airlines are enjoying record profits. For others, falling oil prices are not so good. Geopolitically, it has been a disaster for oil-exporting countries like Russia, Iran, Venezuela, and others are getting clobbered. Shale oil producers, with fracking and horizontal drilling costs that far exceed OPEC's cost for extracting conventional crude oil, are also starting to retrench. This disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street is growing. Ironically, Wall Street has hyped one of the drivers, the shale oil revolution, as a ticket to energy independence and a catalyst for our emergence as a new Saudi Arabia of oil. It seems they forgot that not all oil is created equal, that shale oil depletes rapidly and is infinitely more expensive to extract. While our shale oil production surge has created a temporary oversupply, exacerbated in part by the stagnant global economy and falling oil demand, we should use this reprieve as an opportunity to prepare for the future. And here are six things the author, Michael, could suggest that we do. Number one, purchase oil, quote-unquote, on the cheap, and build our strategic petroleum reserve. China is doing this now to cushion the for hard times that are sure to come, and so should we. Two, replenish our bankrupt highway trust fund by raising the federal tax on gasoline. Three, acknowledge in policy terms that shale oil is not in itself our ticket to energy independence. Its rapid depletion rates and high drilling costs make that impossible. Four, use this quote-unquote reprieve as a launch point for remodeling our transportation and energy systems. Five, beware of black swan events. Desperate nations do desperate things. Oil exporting nations, unable to support their national agendas due to falling oil prices, are ripe for destabilization. Likewise, a panicky Wall Street sell-off of shale oil holdings could trigger something worse. A hint would be, recall how the subprime fiasco started as a ripple. And finally, six, think. As consumers, let's remember what our $4 a gallon gas did to our household budgets and not pretend to pump prices into $2 range is a new norm or is going to be the new norm. It's hard to say how long oil prices will remain low, but history has shown it takes little to trigger and unleash a chain reaction of volatile prices. If gas prices today seem too good to be true, that's because they probably are. My take, I'm under no illusions that the dominant industrial culture will have a come-to-Jesus moment and abandon this death trap of an economy. So for those of us still functioning fully in the dominant fossil fuel-based culture, these recommendations may or may not be beneficial. I'll be in my yard if you need me. Guy?
Thanks, Mike. Our newest segment is called Real or Fake News. In it, we provide a headline, and you, the listener, guess whether it's from the mainstream media or an organization such as The Onion. Today's headline from December 16th reads, New poll finds majority of Americans think torture was justified after 9/11 attacks. Think it over for a minute. New poll finds majority of Americans think torture was justified after 9/11 attacks.
Say it isn't so.
Stunningly, in a sad reflection on the depravity of the American populace, it's real. The headline is from the December 16th issue of the Washington Post, and the tally is nearly 2-1 in favor of torture. On the other hand, a new Pew Research Center survey finds that 73% of Americans believe Jesus was born to a virgin, so really nothing should surprise us anymore.
And ba-dum-bum. All right, this week we have an interview with Albert Bates. Albert is an influential figure in the intentional community and eco-village movements. A lawyer, author, and teacher, he has been director of the Global Village Institute for Appropriate Technology since 1984 and the Eco-Village Training Center at the farm in Summertown, Tennessee since 1994. Albert has been a resident of the farm since 1972. A former attorney, he argued environmental and civil rights cases before the U.S. Supreme Court and drafted a number of legislative acts during a 26-year legal career. The holder of a number of design patents, Albert invented the concentrating photovoltaic arrays and solar-powered automobile displayed at the 1982 World's Fair. He served on the steering committee of Plenty International for 18 years, focusing on relief and development, working with indigenous peoples, human rights, and the environment. Albert first came to national prominence in 1978 when he sued to shut down the entire U.S. nuclear fuel cycle from mines to waste repositories. This case, which went four times to the U.S. Supreme Court and was later profiled in a law review article and two books, was ultimately unsuccessful but raised troubling questions about the health ethics and health effects of nuclear energy and the ethical dimensions and civil liberties implications of the federal role in promoting it. Albert has played a major role in the Eco Village movement and as one of the organizers of the Global Eco Village Network and served as their chairman of the board and president as well. He was also the principal organizer of the Eco Village Network of the Americas and served as its president as well. In 1994, he founded the Eco Village Training Center, a whole systems immersion experience of Eco Village living. He has taught courses in sustainable design, natural building, permaculture, and technologies of the future to students from more than 50 nations. Wow. Welcome to Nature Bats Last, Albert.
Hey, thank you very much for having me. I'm here in the middle of the Yucatan Peninsula on the northern corner of the southern part of Mexico in the middle of a nature preserve called the Yumbalam. And I'm lucky to have a roving internet feed that allows me to get there.
I know I was looking at your list of places you work, contribute, and teach, and it's quite a list with a huge set of different skills. And I guess, though, I'd like to start where your home is, at the farm in Tennessee, and talk about really that and what the primary motivation was behind it, and would you do it again?
Yeah, sure. I'd do it again in a minute. You know that. I jumped in there, and back in 1972, when I finished law school, I threw hiked the Appalachian Trail sort of to get New York City out of my system, and I fell into the farm just on a visit and fell in love with the place and the ethics of it and what they were trying to accomplish. And going to ground in one place really helped me get some perspective, because those free spirits, you know, the hippie essence of San Francisco, were totally aware of the corruption in the global industrial civilization, and they were determined to raise their children in a way more after the fashion of the original inhabitants, you know, recovering the original instructions. So I was grateful to land there.
I visited a couple eco villages over the summer, and one of them in particular was Dancing Rabbit, and met some people who had been to the farm, been to Dancing Rabbit, and were kind of making the tour and trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work as they were going to start their own community. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about maybe some of the pitfalls new communities can avoid based on your vast experience.
Yeah, well, it's a big subject. And there are many, many, many experiments going on around the world in this vein, and have been going on for quite a while. Before I was involved with the Global Ecovillage Network, I was actually part of the what was called then the North American Communal Studies Association. Today it's called the Communal Studies Association because they're more global, or at least continental. And they looked at historical utopias. You know, what were people actually trying to accomplish in places like Amana and Oneida and the Israeli kibbutz and those kinds of things? And there's sort of this tropism, I think, in human DNA, that looks towards what can we do to reboot the system and create something, you know, let's just blue sky it. And what's possible? How can humans really live if they really did what they think would be nice for them instead of all the bullshit? Right. And so, there's been enough examples in history where people sort of step like the fool off the hill and into the clouds and tried for a while to actually do something. And many of them failed, I would say the vast majority. But historically, we find some very stimulating examples. And I was lucky to be part of the farm in that. But, looking around, and that's one of the major resources we have to draw upon, is that historical example, what worked, what didn't. And if you look at communities like Oneida in upstate New York, which was a free love community around the same time as the Civil War, the War of Northern Aggression in the United States, and you look at others, Israeli kibbutz, for instance, or some others, you find that 50% or more of it is what I call the invisible architecture. It's actually not the buildings or the labor system or what their enterprises are or how they get their energy or any of that. It's actually about how they communicate, how they make decisions, how they achieve fairness and transparency and a sense of free participation. It's the buy-in. How do they get to that? What's the glue that holds them all together? So I teach sometimes eco-village design courses, and when I'm teaching, I spend about 50% of the curriculum just on that, just on the idea of how do you get along, because it's strange, but we've lost a lot of those traditional skills that used to sort of be taken for granted that came with the territory if you were an indigenous people living on a harsh piece of land. You had to get along. And you had to develop systems and taboos and ways of doing things that respected each other. And so we have to regain that. We lose that when we sort of become this homogenized industrial print of some kind of system that's a globalized economy where it manufactures all people to look exactly identical and fit into the consumer machine. Well, we lose a lot, and a lot of what we've lost is our ability to get along with each other. And so rebuilding that is a big, big part of having success as a community.
That's awesome. This is Guy Albert. Thanks very much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks.
How does the farm deal with monetary issues? And this comes directly from your last comments, because it seems that our inability to agree on really the value of money is something that divides a lot of us. You don't have to look far. Most married couples, for example, to see periodic disagreements about money. So how does the farm deal with monetary issues?
Well, it's a moving target, I think, and you have to really talk about particulars and particular parts of the farm or particular eras of the farm, because we were wide-eyed idealists back in the 60s and early 70s and came to the land and set up a commune in the strictest sense of meaning of that word, a collective, where nobody had any individual wealth at all. There was no division on the lines of inheritance or property or anything like that. And I was coming to that out of the experience of having graduated law school and had been a sort of a radical lawyer with the National Lawyers Guild. And for me, I was sort of schooled in Marxism. But, the farm was not Marxist. It was not communist. It was not socialist. It was not capitalist. It was not any ist or ism. It was it that they didn't believe in money. They didn't believe in having an exchange. They didn't, and you can understand that. If you've ever done acid and tried to make change from money, it's like, why are we carrying around these pictures of dead presidents? Why are we exchanging these funny purple and pink pictures of people on these bills,
Because we believe it's real.
Yeah. It's like,
I've never done acid, and I ask those questions all the time.
Right. So, but I'm getting to the point of, so it was that we didn't believe in money. And so if you don't believe in money, what do you do next, right? And you can't just barter all the time. You can't just, take your firewood and exchange it for a loaf of bread or something, That's very cumbersome. So some utopian experiments like Twin Oaks, for instance, set up a system of work exchange or work credit system where people had certain kind of tasks that they had to put in so many hours every week and accomplish certain things and that they sort of checked off their their mark on the ledger and that they had done their part, right? Well, the farm didn't have any of that. It was essentially an honor system where you worked and you were expected to work, and there's sort of a peer pressure to work, but you could really do anything you wanted. And because there were enough of us there, there was always somebody who wanted to be on the garbage crew, somebody who wanted to like think about how to make methane digesters out of our sewage or whatever. And there was always something entertaining and inviting there in pretty much every task we had to do. So from that standpoint, everybody just sort of pitched in, and it all worked. I mean, on a large enough scale with enough people, it all worked. And so for the first 13 years, we were in a non-monetary economy. And that's actually a pretty critical period for us. It was a very interesting thing, and I would go back to that in a split second. But it did develop certain fault lines. And one of the fault lines was that there are people who are needy and who are not able to provide in terms of labor or resources, elderly people, handicapped people, people at the margins. There are other people who fall into good positions where they're going to town to work as nail bangers or something, and they have a little bit of extra gas money, and so they buy themselves some treats at the quick stop. And, you know, you get this sort of a hierarchy setting up there of the haves and have-nots, irregardless of how high your ideals were, right? So that sort of crept into our system and began to create schisms and separations. There was also huge mismanagement and foibles and errors and people setting up businesses and mismanaging checkbooks and different kinds of stuff. And it all became a point of, well, you know what? We have really good doctors here at the farm. We've had some very good luck that way in attracting people with medical skill. We've had some really good lawyers come to the farm who were very skilled and set us up sort of bulletproof systems. And then we had no accountants, none, no bookkeepers. And it's like, okay, so we sent some off to learn to do that at college, and they never came back. And like that, you know, that kind of should tell you something.
That's hilarious.
In a sad way.
Yes.
Well, I'm on that stage of grief now. I'm in Duver humor, right? So, So the thing about that is you do need a certain amount of that. And we reorganized. And when we reorganized in the early 80s, what we came to was a dualistic system where you could either, you know, it's kind of like a cafeteria plan. And you could choose to be kind of like the outside economy and have your own income and have your own property and family and so forth there living within the land trust. Or you could become a member of what we called our Second Foundation after Isaac Asimov's series. And in the Second Foundation, it was a collective society within the larger group. And so it's sort of like a family economy. And really, if you think about it, everybody's family that they grew up in was straight communism, you know? Right. I mean, there was no private property in your family. And so that's kind of like the Second Foundation extending that out to 20, 30 people and being able to run that way allows us to have economies of scale with the group. So we buy group purchases. We have a pension plan. We have the ability to handle people who fall through the safety net, or people maybe who have too much and need to kick in more, that kind of thing, to where we level it out and are meeting with more of our ideals again.
So you must have some community level expenses currently, right? So you must have property taxes and insurance and those sorts of things. Where does that money come from?
Well, that's fairly straightforward, and it's pretty similar to most other intentional communities in the country. We have a board of directors that's elected, and we have a budget process that goes on every year where people can put in line items into the budget, and then there's also fixed expenses like land taxes that have to be paid. And then you divide that up among all the dues-paying members of the group, and the typical dues on an average member of the farm might be around $100 per month. So the average adult living in the farm pays $100 every month. And that dues goes into things like road repairs, water systems, paying the water manager, taxes, different kinds of things on the common lands, the common holdings, management of the community infrastructure. And then you have your own expenses, which are, you know, your food and lodging and so forth that you have to deal with. And we have developed, fortunately, over many years, a number of cottage industries where most people don't have to go out and work somewhere else. They can work right directly within the farm. And we have sort of an ecology of systems set up for that. We use the law very creatively, but we find ways to keep it so that it's completely legal, such that we have every kind of corporate structure you can imagine, of 501c3s and 501ds and different C corporations and S corporations. And it's an ecology where we have a Geiger counter business, and so we bid on government contracts. But that business is owned and directed by a legally minority group, which is women. And so as a result, we have a couple extra check boxes that we can check off on our bidding process. So things like that, little bits of leverage that you can get by setting up structures. We do all that. And in that way, we're able to meet our needs while also gaming the system a little bit.
Excellent. Can you tell us a little bit more about those cottage industries, about how many companies and how much money is involved on sort of an annual basis?
Yeah, since the change in 84, it's been difficult for me to keep track because there's so many. Last time I counted, I think, was probably, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, and it was 35 corporations at that time. A lot of those were community corporations for things like the land trust or Plenty, our International Relief and Development Organization. They were nonprofits who raised their money through grants and fundraising and those kinds of things. And then we had a number of mom-and-pop businesses that operate out of people's basements doing various things, microbreweries and whatnot. And then we also have the bigger businesses that are community-owned. They're typically stock-held businesses, like the book publishing company that publishes maybe 30 new titles a year. And then we have the electronics company, which is probably the world's leader in pocket devices for monitoring ionizing radiation and other kinds of interesting things. And then we have the mail order catalog, which carries a whole line of products, which actually is one of our really good reserves because it's selling dried foods and canned goods and various products that might be very useful to keep us going for several months in the event of a shutdown of the economy. Right. So having a warehouse full of stuff for the mail order catalog is a good deal.
I was wondering if you talk a little bit about, I mean, from what the communities I've visited and experienced, that, you know, part of their success and lasting is the relationship with the surrounding community that you know they're part of. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about kind of the history of how that went for the farm.
Yeah, that comes basically to a philosophy that we had going back to the Haight-Ashbury. A lot of this was direct translation of that early San Francisco hippie period. And this was the real white lightning group. This was the group that was the purebred stuff. And so coming to Tennessee, trying to apply those principles of loving your neighbor and extending out to reach out to help out wherever possible, we would cross boundaries like going out and picking our neighbor's tobacco for him when he needed it bad, because even though we didn't do tobacco, you know, and consider it spawn of the devil, it was nonetheless something that we would do for a neighbor. And so we kind of – one of the funny things was most people don't even know this story. I don't think it's been written up yet. But we had somebody within the farm, a very nice woman who was very extroverted and friendly, easy to make friends with. And she was appointed to go out and get to know each and every one of the neighbors that lived within a few miles of us. And so this is a rural farm area. And she would go knock on somebody's door and she would find people who were very old, kind of shut-ins, who needed help, and she would bring them cookies. She would find people who didn't want anything to do with the outside world and, you know, thank you very much and slam the door in her face. And that's okay, too, you know. But in that process, she really extended us out to where people didn't regard us as something scary. And she let them know. She sat down and, with them and helped them out in various ways, washed the dishes and whatever, to the point where she really assuaged all of their fears and just defused any potential situations that way. We did have some hotheads that lived around us, the KKK and so on, and we had some bombings in the early years. We had people show up on horses with shotguns and things. But we had enough friendly neighbors just from that process of making friends with our close neighbors that they were the intermediaries who diffused most of those situations. And we never turned anybody into the police or the FBI or anything. We were always interested just in getting along and making friends.
It's good to have allies, I agree. You're listening to Nature Bats Last in the Progressive Radio Network. Our guest today is Albert Bates. I'm going to shift gears here a little bit, Albert. You recently wrote a piece about the 20th UN Climate Change Conference, and in it you talk about how countries fall into two camps, the Jeffersonians and Hamiltonians. Could you break that down for our listeners to help them better understand the dynamic of these talks?
Yeah, so I'm not sure what you want to know. Is it what came out of Lima? What the whole COP20 thing was?
Yeah, like, you know, what your take on some of that and the different dynamics between the countries, particularly, obviously, the heavies of the North
versus
the South.
Right. Well, you know, I've been going to COPs for a long time. As part of the Global Ecovillage Network, we were one of the main UN participants there trying to push an agenda of reestablishing the definition of habitat and how you can live on the Earth in a way that didn't produce a large carbon footprint, in fact, was carbon negative. And so as somebody who's been to more COPs than I care to remember, I think that quite a lot came out of Lima by the standards of the UN, which are best compared to a snail dragging a brick.
Right.
None of us would have predicted after Copenhagen at, say, Cancun or Doha, that going into Paris and a legally binding treaty next December, the target would have dropped to 1.5 degrees from 2 degrees, or that the carbon debate would take up issues like stranded assets and conclude that we needed to leave it in the ground to get to zero emissions globally by 2050 or maybe 2040. So going into this one, we talked about, you know, the post-2015 gap, which was similar to the compliance gap that came after Kyoto, but it was just talk, and no one in the civil sector thought it would go anywhere. But in fact, Lima put a mechanism into place, you know, ways of closing the gap. And it put in mechanisms to measure political targets, goals that were coming up with in these UN meetings against actual science to address carbon tax and reward schemes and other amazing changes. And, of course, all of this was ignored by Amy Goodman, Naomi Klein, the Rainforest Action Network, Indigenous Peoples Network, and many of the other NGOs who are basically invested in protest. So my own feeling is that you need two things before you protest. Otherwise, you're just blowing smoke. You need a goal, a clear vision of the end game. What is it you want your target audience, whether that's the government or public opinion or owners of a company, to do? Is it something they can do? And secondly, you need to have purged yourself of the scourge that you're protesting. Otherwise, you're just a hypocrite. Now, I don't want to be too strict with this. I mean, we all have to live, and it's okay to, you know, protest factory farming, for instance, even if you occasionally have a BLT at the corner diner. And you can come out in sympathy of bike lanes even if you don't bike. I also think it's okay to protest nuclear and coal power without decoupling yourself from the grid. But if you're protesting school shootings and you're packing yourself, or you're protesting Wall Street and capitalism and you have an IRA full of trendy securities and mutual funds, you need to do some self-analysis about what you really want to happen. So, you know, I think permaculture is at the core about making ethical choices for yourself, your family, you know, the village, the planet. And you start with you, zone zero. You change that first, and then you can engage in radical acts of withdrawing support for everything else. So going back to the UN, what we saw there was sort of people who are liberally minded, what I call the Jeffersonians, who see it as a process of education, but everybody needs to take care of everybody else. And the world as a whole is your family, and you need to begin to think about nobody gets out of this without some damage and without some urgency and without some commitment to do some change. And at the same time, you have to confront the Hamiltonians, which are, you know, are the Republicans, the Boehners, the people who think, well, our family is our one percenters. It's the elite, and that's who we're really protecting here. And there's a whole lot of that in UN meetings. There's a whole lot of that control, and corporations are there big time, and they're buying up as much space as they can get. So we engage with this, but we engage in this as a way of saying that there is a better way. And even if you're a complete doomer and you think it's all just farts in the wind at this point, you're engaging with the process in order to make that remaining time as good as it possibly can be. And so we're starting to build something there, and we're working with all the different people involved. And I'm actually pleased to see that this most recent meeting came out more on the side of the Jeffersonians and less on the Hamiltonian side.
Well, and your final statement there suggests a Buddhist-inspired approach as well, that we can't predict with certainty what's going to happen next week, next year, next decade. So we should take right actions independent of the outcome and sort of remain detached from the outcome.
Yeah, absolutely. I follow with Suzuki, Shinro Suzuki there, where he said life is getting into a boat and rowing out and sinking. That's a Zen master.
Yes, and some people don't even get to row the boat.
Right. Yeah.
They just go along for the ride, and then they sink.
Yeah.
So there's finally a conversation about phasing out fossil fuels by 2050, and I suspect that won't be a problem. Yeah, I mean, even the conservative International Energy Agency indicates business as usual takes us to 60 above baseline in 2050. So, there's been a significant shift in thinking, but is it enough? I appreciate the intention, but it seems to me the conclusion, however noble, is too late and still not urgent enough in terms of the timetable. So can you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, I can comment on that a lot, actually. But it's like if you're in the bottom edge of an exponential curve, and you just begin to feel the liftoff, and you're still running along, kind of like this gradual increase of knowledge, increase of awareness, increase of agreement, through the process of 20, 30 years of these kind of ridiculous meetings. And now suddenly you're starting to feel the force of gravity. It feels like actually you're leaving the ground. You're starting to move upwards. And what lies further on that slope, further on that exponent, is a straight upward movement. And so that's the hopeful thing. That's the peace I felt, was that we stopped talking about 4 degrees or 2 degrees as being some kind of attainable goal that would save the planet. It was actually 1.5 was the major discussion, and that's pretty solid now, and seems like that's what's going to be in the Paris Agreement. And, of course, we're already at 1.5, so let's get serious. I mean, that's baked in the cake. There's no way to get below 1.5 at this point.
Based on James Hansen's work and subsequent follow-up work over the last couple of years, 2C is baked in even with collapse of industrial civilization.
So, yeah, and we don't, Guy, we don't even know if 17C isn't baked in already.
That's right.
So, I mean, this could be, we could be on Venus and not know it yet, or for the most part, just suspecting. But on the other hand, this is a shift. This is not indiscernible. I've actually felt the ground move. I felt that sucker move a little bit. And so, talking about the gaps in of ambition and talking about was all just talk. But now they're actually putting in mechanisms. They're closing the gap between science and politics quite a bit, and having review mechanisms and ways of calibrating it. So if they realize that they're not going to make a 2-degree goal, or a 1.5 degree goal, they can actually implement more stuff. Well, what their stuff they're talking about is mostly voluntary still. That's still to come. All of that kind of hard work is still to come. But what I'm sensing here is that, oh, there's a lot more people starting to get it at high levels of government.
Yes. So I want to change the subject back where we started, back to the farm a little bit. And when I was at Age of Limits about a year and a half ago, you went through the history. And obviously there's been another year and a half of history since then. And I don't remember it particularly well. Can you remind me how many people you started with? What was your peak number of people and where you're at now?
I would say we started with 320 people getting off the buses in 1971 in Tennessee, coming out of a Monday night class, monthly or weekly meetings in San Francisco, running upwards of 2,000 people. And that many, 320 who survived two times across the country and finding the land. And then you had the following year was up to about 500, the year after that about 800. So I got there when it was about 500 people. And then it went up to 1,000, 1,200, 1,400. There's about 4,000 people in the whole system when you had all those 20 satellite farms in three continents all calculated. We're all hooked up by ham radio and actually a ham video and things like that. So we were pretty wired at even those early days of the 70s, and then it sort of hit the wall. You know, we hit the Peter Principle. We reached our maximum level of incompetence that we could sustain. You know, how many hippies does it take to screw in a light bulb? You know, and so we had to get to the point where we were stable again, or else they were just going to repossess it and was going to get bulldozed like Morningstar or Drop City or one of those early other experiments. So we reorganized, and at that point, I think the peak would have been around 1980, 81, 82. I think there's some pretty good articles written back then around by Mother Earth News and others that detail the population at about 1,000 to 1,200. And then we slid, and it was in a decline phase preceding the changeover. People left sort of in advance of the change because we were selling out the revolution by changing, or it was just too hard, too tough, didn't want to stick around. And then there was the people who left right after the change, and then there were people who stayed in like after the party and did the dishes and cleaned up. And I was in that group, you know, and that we got down to maybe as few as 100, 125. And now we're up around, I would say, depends on who you ask. We have people who are there who are students and they go off to school in the school year. And we have people who are there who are working in other parts of the world like me and are not always home. So it's hard to get a fix on the exact population. I would say there's roughly 90 to 150 regular people living there, and then there's maybe another 50 or so, maybe 75 more who are there quite often. So it's kind of like that. Somewhere between 150 and 250 is a pretty robust number for a pretty average size. But you also understand that over that time, there's also those who kind of moved off the farm, away from the farm, but not very far away, and they bought land right next to the farm. And so we had this whole ring around us, and it's like Floyd, Virginia, or Austin, Texas, or one of these places where there's just a whole shitload of hippies all living in the middle where you wouldn't expect them, you know? And so they're out there cheek to jowl with the hillbillies, and living in the farm style, using the farm's wonderful school and all of our lovely stores and stuff, and maybe working in the farm sometimes. And, you know, our school now has it's a hub for homeschoolers. So we're actually a certified school with actual physical brick-and-mortar school, but we also have 1,000 students enrolled this year, or maybe 1,200, from the homeschoolers who use us to help with curriculum development and testing and things.
That's impressive.
Yeah, so of those 150 to 250, how much interaction is there? Is there a weekly potluck? Is there, I mean, do you see 200 people once a month, once a week? Do you even know all their names? I'm just sort of trying to get a feel for it.
I don't know all their names because of, you know, they're having kids all the time, and I don't keep up with those kids. I can generally tell a family line, though. You know, I'm like fourth generation myself on the farm now, so I can pretty much tell just by the look of somebody whose family they're part of. You know, I can do that off of a kid pretty easy. But the thing is, we do see each other quite a lot. We have usually at least a weekly potluck dinner or prepared dinner, like a benefit for the school or a benefit for Plenty or one of our other charities. At the farm school, we'll have a community dinner. We have regular meetings that are business meetings of the community every couple months. We have events like community work days pretty much every Saturday. And we also have a lot of music events and things where people come together for parties. So I will see the whole, you know, multiple generation conglomerate together, dancing together at least on a weekly basis most of the summer, and maybe a little bit less than that in the cold months of the year.
That's impressive.
That is very impressive. Let's switch gears here and finish up with what you do out there. You know, when you're gone, you know, permaculture design, eco village design, biochar, wild fermentation. These are some of the areas that you teach, you know, globally. And I was wondering if you could talk about what you're seeing out there when you're interacting with folks. And do you see a shift in thinking? And do you see anything significant happening as far as, you know, I guess, challenging the dominant culture that's taking over or is taken over?
Well, what I'm doing right here in Mexico right now, and going to be doing in Belize next month. Incidentally, let me throw in a plug. Anybody who wants to get a permaculture design course under their belt and know a little bit more about permaculture, come to Belize next month, February 21st to March 6th. Me and Starhawk and Marisha Auerbach and Chris Nesbitt, we're teaching a course at the Maya Mountain Research Farm in permaculture design, and about half of that course is going to be indigenous peoples. They're the local Maya, and the other half are people who are coming in from other places that help pay for the system that makes it happen. So, you know, it's a great place to learn permaculture because it's an operating farm that's really doing everything that Bill Mollison ever preached about. You know, food forestry, we're feeding the entire group from about a 300-yard radius of the building. So come there and learn permaculture, and you can just look it up on my website, or maybe we can put a link up on it. So what I'm doing is I'm working in this area that we're calling carbon farming. E.O. Wilson was asked by a young undergrad what area of science he would go into today if he were that age and he could choose, and he said soil science. So that's where I'm at now. I'm teaming with microbes. I'm teaming with nutrients. I'm working on soil science. I really see that as a frontier. And you know what I've also learned is that it's actually a complete solution. Well, I won't say complete. It is a solution to the climate dilemma. However, it is not a complete solution because the other part is will. It's about actual being able to change our wicked ways and go straight here on. And, you know, we have this this process that we're learning about, which is how we are all so amazingly interconnected, that it's not just us discrete as human meat, as a discrete entity, but that we are totally immersed in a quantum universe. 99% of us is other DNA than our own, that lives within our body and makes all our vital functions work. And that same is true of all the creatures in nature, and the trees, and the sky, and the oceans, and all that, that there's this amazing microbial community that ties it all and interweaves it all. It is the force that runs through everything. And it's all intercommunicating with each other all the time. And so that actually is a wonderful revelation when you finally get around to seeing it. And what it tells you also is that thing knows how to fix stuff. That thing knows how to heal the planet. If you let that thing loose and don't get in its way, it can fix us. And if you help it, if you feed it, if you give it what it likes, like lots of sex, it will, in fact, move faster and do more. So that's what I'm spending a lot of time working on these days, you know. And it's funny because it gets conflated with geoengineering when I talk about carbon farming, which is really kind of funny, you know. And geoengineering, you think about the collapse of the North Atlantic fishery, you know, in the early 1990s as just one of many examples of how human beings tend to worsen the problems that they try to solve. You know, and Seneca, the philosopher, the Roman philosopher, understood that about 2,000 years ago, and he said it would be some consolidation for the feebleness of ourselves and our works if all things should perish as slowly as they come into being. But as it is, increases are of sluggish growth, and the way to ruin is rapid. And it's this curve that we're kind of fixated on. We're fixated on this idea that we're in a gradual descent or decline of civilization, and this is the backside of Hubbard's Peak or something like that. But that's actually wrong. That's not a very good way to look at things because crashes happen fast. The Seneca effect accounts for greed and incompetence and government support for both of those. And, you know, the fall off is very steep. And so we need to think, you know, about actually how does nature do its work? And nature works in cycles too. Spring and fall, planting and harvesting. It's an ebb and flow of things. And so if we begin to work with that and begin to realize these things are cyclical, we can actually boost the speed of the uptick of some of these biological systems and begin to work biologically, and we store more carbon in the soils and store more carbon in the carbon sinks of the planet. And that is what they're calling geoengineering, but what I call carbon farming. And it's what I teach and what I'm going to do now. And, you know, I'm working here in the Yumbalam doing hugel culture, which is putting carbon into the ground directly. That's what makes me get up in the morning with a little bit of spring in my step. I know that I'm going to spend the day doing a lot of tree planting. And that makes me feel really good about this whole natural healing process. And I just need for a whole bunch of humans to get out of the way of it. And I'm not sure what that's going to take, but the sooner the better.
Excellent.
Yes, indeed. I agree regarding soil. I had a soils professor in graduate school who famously said, probably a few thousand times while I was in graduate school, that any vegetation that can't be explained with soil isn't worth explaining. That's one of the reasons why on my homestead we have a biochar kiln to increase microbial populations and therefore enhance available nitrogen. So my takeaway question for you, what's next? Where do you go from here after Yucatan and Belize, and what's the next stage of your life? Where are you headed?
Oh, good. You're giving me another chance for another plug.
Yes.
Okay. Here's the plug. It's a URL, igg.me/at/hippies. That's nice. My Indiegogo campaign, ig.me@hippies. And it's an Indiegogo campaign which is running now until the end of February to create a hippie museum at the farm. We're building a big auditorium, and we just had an amazing exhibit at the Tennessee State Museum. They had a couple hundred objects that they borrowed from us and put on display right there at the state capitol for a couple months. And I want to keep all that collection together. I want to put it into a permanent display, and I'm building a museum out of mud. I'm building it out of clay and sand and straw and volunteer labor and perma blitzes and apprentice programs and things like that. So go to my Indiegogo campaign. You could just Google hippies and you'll probably find it, and help me out with that. That's all I'm really needing is about a few thousand dollars to have enough clay and sand and straw on hand that when the volunteers arrive, they'll have stuff to work with.
Excellent.
That's
Why don't
great.
You put that link on our Nature Bats Last NPRN.fm Facebook page.
Okay, yeah, I'll give you a graphical link.
Yeah, that'd be great.
That'd be great. Thanks very much, Albert Bates, for joining us on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network, and we were joined by Albert Bates. Thanks very much, Albert.
Thanks, Albert.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, each week we seek out a doomer who not only goes beyond the status quo, but also provides insightful and useful information. Our doomer for this week is an anonymous young woman. She's married and is the mother of a toddler. I met her via Facebook nine days ago when she sent me a message. She'd recently seen one of my presentations on video. Among her first messages was this one. Quote, I am angry at this point beyond belief. I just hope that when we go, it'll be quick because they didn't do anything. My own son didn't do anything to deserve this, end quote. She was clearly very upset and very angry, having seen one of my recent presentations. Only a week later, she'd clearly come a long way. Quote, since hearing your message, I have learned to see the world with much more appreciation. I don't argue with my husband anymore. I let my son be happy. No more constraints or pressures. It's not the ideal life that I had pictured in my mind, but if we are going to go out, I want to make sure to be with them and love them every second. And then in one of her most recent messages, she'd clearly grok the whole thing. At the edge of extinction, she writes, only love remains. She's quoting the tagline from a forthcoming component at Nature Bats Last. I had recently sent her a draft of this new video series I'll be implementing on the blog, which concludes with, at the edge of extinction, only love remains. And she was quoting it back to me. So thanks very much for that.
Well, speaking of Nature Bats Last, do you have a climate update this week?
Yes, I do. A paper in the December 15th, 2014 issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences provides the most comprehensive picture with respect to how Greenland's ice is vanishing. The primary conclusion, surprising only to mainstream scientists, quote, Greenland may lose ice more rapidly in the near future than previously thought. And I can't even imagine how many times I've heard that line, that things are happening so much faster than we expected from the mainstream climate science community.
Well, on that note, that about wraps it up for this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page, Nature Bats Last, and the Progressive Radio Network, and join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.fm. Feel free to post questions you'd like us to address on the show, and please continue to follow Guy's blog, GuyMcPherson.com, for further updates, essays, and his speaking tours. We'll see you on the radio next Tuesday evening, and if you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.fm and rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to all the excellent contributions this week, and to Afrozen and Rianne Farragut for the music. Until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
Nature Bats Last.
She bats last and she's coming out.